Welcome to Silicon Subcontinent. My name is Aman.
And my name is Shreyans.
We're both fourth-year computer science students at Berkeley and Rice, respectively. We both interned at Microsoft and are returning there full-time as product managers at Microsoft's headquarters. We're deeply interested in the Indian entrepreneurship ecosystem and figuring out the next steps to India's economic growth. This is why we started Silicon Subcontinent, where we talk to friends in India and the US to discuss India's growth story from an entrepreneurial lens. Today's guest is no stranger to growth and has in fact played a key role in creating tech-friendly policy in the Indian government at the central level that is poised to help both the common man as well as enterprises to reach the next level of growth. Abhishek Singh is the CEO of the Digital India Corporation and has almost two decades of experience in public policy. Most recently, he was leading the initiative to build the CoWin app, the app that was used to help vaccinate crores of Indians. We're so excited to have you, Abhishek. How are you doing?
Hi, good. I'm good. Good to have you guys here and good to know that you guys are away and studying and planning your careers at this young age and still following what's going on in India.
Yeah, of course. We're very connected to the Indian ecosystem at all times.
So Abhishek, tell us about your background before joining public policy and give us some insight into where you were brought up.
Well, I had my early schooling in Ranchi, which is in a state called Jharkhand. It used to be part of Bihar earlier. And growing up in those days in the 80s, if I look back and I compare with the career options the youngsters, my children have today, at that point of time, we had only two career options when we were in school. Either you will become an engineer or you become a doctor. And if you would not qualify for the entrance examinations for the IITs or the regional engineering colleges or for the medical colleges, it used to appear as if the self-esteem and the social respect of your parents was in danger. So it was too much of pressure, too much pressure from school and everyone that that's the way to do it. There is no other no other way that you could do. The Ranchi University, the local university which was there, was seized with a lot of problems. A three-year course used to take 5 years. And it was general accepted fact that you have to leave the town and you have to find a college or a university wherein you can go for your higher studies. So that way we all studied for engineering or medicine, all my classmates and all. I was lucky to have got a seat in IIT Kanpur. I joined engineering and based on my rank, in fact, we didn't have even counseling. And we are talking of pre-internet days. We didn't even know what it is to do a mechanical engineering.
Right.
But I got mechanical engineering in IIT Kanpur because my rank said so. And that was the historical data that was available. And so I filled in the counseling forms based on previous year's data without any access to the data analytics and to the career options and all, which you guys will have today to look at. And I joined mechanical engineering first semester. I realized engineering drawing is something that I'm not made to be. I was not able to conceptualize anything. I immediately went to my dean of academic affairs and said that I want a branch change. Can I go down to, because in those days, the pecking order of departments was computer science, followed by electrical engineering, followed by mechanical, civil, chemical and all. I said, I'm happy to go down to chemical or civil, but mechanical is something which I'm not made up for. He said the policy is that you have to get a perfect 10, which is equivalent to the perfect 4 that you guys have. Perfect 10 in the first year to get a branch change. I said, if I'm struggling to pass a course in engineering drawing, how will I get a perfect 10? So it was like just impossible. So I was destined to stay there, and there was no way I could call up my parents and say that I don't want to do mechanical engineering. I would rather opt in for a BSc economics or a BA in humanities, because that would again be like disastrous for the social milieu we were in. So I was stuck with mechanical engineering, but that was the time when I decided that maybe I will be selling soaps or I'll be doing coding or whatever, or joining public policy, but I will not be doing engineering. Somehow managed to spend 4 years. And that was the way I finally decided, because those days, even after graduation, today again, those guys who are graduating this year have multiple options, to multiple career options in front of them. But we had three career options, either to go for higher studies in the US or go for guys would go write MBA exams and go into selling soaps or write the civil services. So I was not interested in leaving the country because of several reasons. So since I was stuck there and I was not interested in selling soap, I decided to write for civil services. The public policy was something which you used to attract us, especially growing up in North India and looking at how the government is bigger than what it should be and how the impact it creates. So that's kind of, yeah, in short, my journey from a small town boy in Ranchi, growing up in Kanpur, getting surrounded by what was going on. And 88-92 was a very active period. If you look at governance issues, challenges, Babri Masjid, yeah, so riots, so that attracted to me to the civil services. So I decided to join. I decided write for the civil service exam and was lucky enough to get through and join the administration in India.
Definitely. I mean, I that decision has worked out pretty well, I guess, in hindsight. But yeah, that's very awesome to hear. So you mentioned, you know, that people wanted to go abroad or get an MBA even then. What do you think made people think that way, even in those times? Had the mindset changed a little bit over the years?
See, people used to look at role models, and people used to see what people who have graduated from IITs are doing. And that was the way to go. Like, if you want to make a lot of money, you will write an MBA exam, you'll try to become an investment banker or something. If you study, wanted to, if you're academically inclined, if you wanted to go into academics or teaching or go into higher research or look for opportunities in the West, people would try to do an MS or a PhD and go into that line. Or, you know, the third option, of course, was civil services, because that used to attract. So if I can say, interest in the discipline that you had, those guys wanted to go for higher studies. Those who were attracted by money, they would go in for MBA kind of, CAT kind of examinations. And those who were like kind of wanted to do something for the social causes and were looking at the power part of it, those are driven by the power that comes with joining the civil services, would write for civil services. It's much different now, because yesterday, in fact, I was talking to IIT Kanpur students. They launched this event called Tech Kriti. Mm-hmm. And so that's their technical innovation fair kind of, mm-hmm, thing. So I was speaking at that event along with the director of IIT Kanpur. And last week, I was talking to the entrepreneurship cell of IIT Madras. So there, when I talk to the youngsters now, the people of your generation, one big area which has opened up is entrepreneurship. Startups, and people are dreaming to make product companies. People are not looking to get a job and do a 10 to 5 work and get used to it. They are looking at creating value. They are looking at ideas, trying to look at how ideas can be transformed into products, and they are exploring multiple options. I mean, in all the innovation challenges that we have been doing as part of MyGov in the last few years, what we find is that we get a lot of entries from students from their dorms, and they are all dreaming big. All of them want to do something. Yeah. And India has a very vibrant startup ecosystem. In fact, we are looking at the data, like in the digital space, yeah, we found more than 8,000 startups were incubated last year, and 12 of them have become unicorns. So there is a huge opportunity that has opened up in the field of entrepreneurship, in the field of building your own companies, and trying to create products that can add value to the society as well as to the industry. And that is something which was not there at that point of time. In a limited way, in bigger cities they were, but that's greatly changed and is going to impact India and the world in a big way in the days to come.
That's great to hear that you're still in touch with your alma mater, and B, you're seeing things at the ground level and there's so much activity going on. So that's definitely a change. But you also mentioned the fact that parents' social status goes down if the kid doesn't do engineering or becomes a doctor. I think that's still partly true, but definitely, even with my experience, and I think Shreyans can speak to this as well, that we're also seeing a lot of our friends and a lot of our peer group move towards entrepreneurship a lot more compared to previous generations. And I think there's a bunch of things that are happening in India today that are sort of driving this change. One is simply the increase in the number of people on the internet. I feel like Jio especially has driven this huge shift towards the mobile internet, which has brought on a lot more people. And I think the second part is just because of this internet access, people are looking at the world around them, and they're seeing that there's a lot more to the world than just the typical 9-to-5 or the 10-to-5 that you mentioned. So that is definitely something that's really great to hear from you as well. One thing I'd like to ask you, as someone who's sort of gone through the entire career journey that you have, do you feel like this entrepreneurship thing is just a phase, or is India really sort of becoming one of the next tech hubs or entrepreneurship hubs of the world, and this craze or this phase is going to continue?
See, if you look back and say last 25 years, India has established itself, especially with the field of IT. India has established as a leading service provider as far as IT services are concerned. So we are not there as far as products are concerned. But now greatly what we are looking at is that this shift is happening. There are a lot of Indian companies who are looking at designing and building products which are different from the products which are normally commonly used worldwide. Like when the pandemic struck last year, and we were looking at the video conferencing solutions, and there were questions raised about over dependence on Zoom or Microsoft Teams. The question that immediately came to us was that, can we not have an Indian video conferencing solution? We are such a big country, our domestic demand is so much. So what we did was that we launched an innovation challenge. We said that let's try to find out if there are companies who can build solutions, because there are a lot of open source solutions which are available on top of it. We can build VC solutions with value adds on it. So we did this innovation challenge. Within 2 weeks, we were surprised to get more than 2,000 entries. And they were all Indian companies. And we had not even said Indian companies or startups. We said that it can be any group of people, students, who have some idea, and let them present it, and we will give them 3 months to build the prototype. And if during that time, they can incorporate their company or startup. But we are looking to do that. And at the end of it, we will give a contract, a government contract, for 3 years. The government will be using it and will pay a sum of money. We will announce a sum of 1 crore, which is like 10 million Indian rupees, for towards that contract. So that attracted a lot of companies. And ultimately, instead of one, we have shortlisted 4 companies who are building these solutions. Okay. And some of them, we are already using it. And the features in many of them are better than what we see in Microsoft Teams or Zoom also. Like the one that we have started using, the one that will be used for the faceless assessments of income tax department. So now income tax has gone to a faceless assessment in which the assessee officer and the assessor will not be meeting in person. It will be done through anonymously, but through a video chat. So our Indian homegrown solution, it's a small company based in Jaipur who have built that solution. And there, the features that they have built in include something like AI tools to reduce ambient noise. And the way it works is that, suppose I have joined a call, a meeting call in middle of a traffic, and there's a lot of noise going around, as it commonly happens in traffic in India. So what that tool does is that if you switch on that filter, it cuts off all the traffic noise and only the human voice is transmitted. So if suppose my dog is barking in behind, you will not hear the dog's voice. You will just hear my voice. So that's a huge application. Similarly, video filters. Like if you're sitting in a dark corner and if your face is not visible, it will light up your face. So those solutions have features which will make them better than any other solution that we have. So there is a lot of scope, a lot of potential. Today, we look at worldwide. Most big tech companies, many of them are led by people of Indian origin, people who had their basic education in India. And not only that, I'm not talking only of the CEOs. If you look at the core strength of many of the big tech companies, they all are people who had their early education in India. So if these people can go abroad and build the solutions there, why can't they do it here? And the kind of opportunity that we are looking at, especially in the field of data science, in the field of artificial intelligence, what we find is that the kind of data sets that are available in India today are unparalleled. No other country has access to this kind of data as we have. China, I'm not sure, but given our population, we have more access to data and the digitization that has happened. And once we have the skill sets to build in AI-based solutions, artificial intelligence-based solutions, these solutions will not only work in India, but they will work worldwide. If you look at the Stanford AI Index, Vibrancy Index, which was published only last week, they have said India is classified India as one of the countries, the second, in fact, after Brazil, we have the country with the largest number of skilled workforce in the field of AI. our skills, AI skills penetration index is the highest in the world. And it's not the highest, 2.83 times the world average. So we have a good ecosystem. Yeah. We have the engineering colleges. We have all institutions which are training people in data science and AI. And in the next few years, in the next 3 to 5 years, if I can say, the number of companies that will be incubated, which will be using artificial intelligence technologies and data science to build solutions, will be many. So the Indian startup ecosystem is just unfolding. And these product companies will be there. They will offer products which work not only in India. And if anything works at the population scale in India, it will definitely work anywhere else. So that's the potential we are looking at. That's the opportunity we are looking at. Of course, what we lack is in having sufficient research papers, sufficient research which is done, the computational capabilities that that are needed. But efforts are on way to build that, to strengthen our IITs and the top engineering colleges in having access to the best of the supercomputers and provide them opportunities to run algorithms on that, to have more tie-ups with industry, to have more tie-ups with government, wherein students in the final year can build solutions which can be modified, which can be developed into products. So we are looking at continuation of this process, and I foresee, like, in the next few years, we will transform from a software services providing nation to a software product nation, and that will be real, that will be our real calling.
Yeah, I want to pause on that specific note for a second, because I think what you mentioned there is a very, very important point for a lot of our viewers and a lot of the people who are listening into this podcast, that India has traditionally always been viewed as a services country. It started to come up along with China, and perhaps is still coming up. But I think that transition from a services IT-based country where there's cheap workforce, yes, but mostly there's a lot of call centers, there's a lot of resources that are handled. Companies outside of India hire workforce in India, to a more Make in India initiative and a more product-minded sort of country that you're witnessing is rising. But just to keep that aside for a second, I want to talk a little bit more about the policy aspect, because I think we at least Aman and I, we believe that a lot of the innovation and entrepreneurship that is happening today is happening at the intersection of three things. It's happening at the intersection of policy, because the government is helping these startups, entrepreneurs to come up and start these businesses. It's happening at the intersection of capital, which is there's so much capital in this area, and it's starting to actually come in. Earlier, you could imagine that you only had businesses, people had ideas, but there wasn't enough capital. But now we're at this pivotal moment in our journey where there's a lot more capital that is flowing in into businesses and startups and entrepreneurs. And the third, obviously, is the individuals and the technology themselves. What tech is being built in India, and what individuals are being educated? And that's at the intersection of these three is where all the innovation is happening. You come from a more policy side of this trifecta. What are you seeing in terms of how's the government helping this innovation happen? What policy is driving this change?
See, government over the last few years has taken several steps which clearly spell out that the measures that we'll be taking to support startups, to support people who are building building solutions in, number one, the government procurement processes. Mm-hmm. Earlier, what used to happen was that to qualify for a government tender or to qualify for a government procurement process, you needed to have so much of turnover, so many employees on your roll, so many years of existence, and startups would never be able to compete with them. And it always used to become a big boys group. Like there will be a TCS, there will be Infosys, there will be a Tech Mahindra, who are already established. And for newer companies to break into that would be difficult because they will be eliminated in the pre-qualification round. So one big change that was done at the policy level when the procurement process were spelled out was that startups which were registered with DPIIT, Department of Promotion of Internal Investment and Trade, they made this exemption that startups will be exempted from the requirement of turnover and previous experience criteria. So that was a big enabler which allowed startups also to bid for projects. And what we found was that if I have a smaller company building a solution for me, their CEO will be invested there. If I have an Infosys or a TCS, which has a huge company, which have mega, which have billions of dollars of projects world over, for them, a smaller government contract will be a smaller team that will be handling it.
Perfectly.
So the stakeholder involvement was better. And we found that many of these companies delivered very well. Then the other thing that was done was that, especially in the field of manufacturing and the field of products, was that the government e-marketplace was set up. The government e-marketplace is an e-online marketplace for government procurements, because government does a lot of procurement. Like the every year, like the government procurement is more than almost 100,000 crores. So this was like mirrored with lot of corruption and lot of favoritism, nepotism. You would always buy from people you know, and most people, most newbies will not even know who is buying what. So this was transformed into an e-marketplace wherein buyers and sellers could register themselves. And it provided everyone who had a product to show it on the on that portal. If you go to gem.gov, it's like an Amazon of India, Amazon of government, like wherein government will also buy online stuff. And then we also introduce things like reverse auction and all. So if there is competitive products, if you're buying laptops, if you're buying any other electronic devices or air conditioners or water coolers, there could be reverse auction there. So we would always find the right price, and it would allow a level playing field for everyone. So that was a big enabler that they did that. Over and above, there was tax benefits that have been given to startups, to entrepreneurs at the policy level. Workshops have been organized. Investors, see, the biggest challenge that startups and entrepreneurs face is access to capital. What has happened is that most startups and entrepreneurs who have exited and who have got investments from VCs and all, they are dependent largely on Chinese money or the Western money. Or since last year, because of reasons obvious to all, the Chinese money supply has come down, or the startups themselves are not looking at getting investments from China for strategic reasons. So the only supply remains is the Western funds from the Western countries, the VCs and all. But that limits the opportunities that people can access funds to. So now what we are trying to encourage is to set up Indian high net worth Indians who have investable surpluses to understand how this investment in startups and entrepreneurship works. And then we have started coming up, and there are already some groups which have started committing funds for that. So we have an organization called Invest India who works closely with this kind of issues with investors, bringing investors together, bringing startups together, and creating more opportunities for them, giving them tax benefits. Because very often, if you invest something in a startup, you are doing it without the guarantee of a return. So how do we ensure that that you are not harassed by the tax collectors for that? So those the tax norms and agent investing and all have been liberalized, and more such promotions have been done. Startup India is again an organization which is working very closely with startups. The innovation challenges have been organized, as I mentioned, the video conferencing challenge I mentioned. We also did an app innovation challenge. Last year, we did the Responsible AI for Social Empowerment Summit, in which we encourage AI-based startups to build their products and showcase on the world. In the social media space, the new companies have come in, like a very young company called Koo came in, which was a rival to Twitter. So we have been like trying to encourage that. Government has created accounts on that, and we are trying to ensure that they are able to compete with the best in the world. There are companies which are building maps. Map My India is one of them. It's which has built maps. So like when we built the COVID app, so vaccine locator was to be put on the COVID app. So we use the Map My India interface rather than Google Maps interface, which would have been the normal standard choice. But then we would be strengthening the monopolies that exist. So that are several ways in which all this is being supported. And then the one big policy push has been done in the manufacturing space. Mm-hmm. Because what we realized was that our forex outgo on import of mobile phones and electronics products was becoming higher than that on petroleum products also. Hmm. So in order to, and India is a huge user of electronics products.
Yes.
So in order to boost electronics manufacturing, we launched the performance linked incentive scheme for manufacture of mobile phones last year. During the pandemic, the scheme was launched and we got very good response. In fact, almost all the top manufacturers of the Foxconn, the Wistrons, and the manufacturers of the Apple phones or the Samsung, they all have set shop in India, along with several Indian companies. They have been given PLI, performance incentives, so that in case you produce these many devices and export this much, you get a 4 to 6% of incentive from the government. So that has led to pushing manufacturing, and today we have become the second largest manufacturer of mobile phones in India. This year, the PLI scheme, the Performance Linked Incentive Scheme, has been extended to 10 more sectors. In fact, on the last week only, we launched the PLI scheme for manufacture of mobile, of laptops and notebooks and wearables in from our ministry, and other departments are also doing that. So a combined policy push for encouraging startups, entrepreneurs, and pushing manufacturing has been the strategy the government has adopted.
Yeah, I mean, the last 10 minutes have sort of told me about so many opportunities I didn't know even existed. So the fact that there's a push on sort of empowering startups with capital, empowering manufacturers with these schemes that help them sort of create at a sort of incentivized rate. It's just amazing what the government is doing. So as sort of an outsider who wasn't aware of these opportunities before, is there some sort of central website or some specific sources where anyone can go and see what the government is up to in terms of policy? Because, for example, you mentioned the GEM website. I was actually just looking at it right now while you were talking, and it just lists out all the things that you can do on that website. So, I mean, I think it's great. So what can a common man do to understand when these policies are released and to just see and look for opportunities themselves?
See, most of the BuyGov portal that is there, which is run by my ministry, and I happen to be the CEO, that does a lot of information dissemination with regard to all these schemes. With regard to specifically, if you look at startups and investors and people looking at opportunities in India, the Invest India is a very good portal, the investindia.gov.in. or the startupindia.gov.in, so which provides all the details which anyone requires for investments in India or for starting a business or getting to know how things work, because very often people are intrigued by the bureaucracy that we have and by the myriad rules and procedures, and people think that it's too complicated. Yes, it can appear to be to begin with, but when you start navigating it, when you get to the right websites and the right resources, you get how one can do that. So we have, like most state governments have come up with single window approaches for giving clearances. The getting environmental clearances have come out, become very easy for getting land, for setting up a shop. Department of DPIIT, in fact, we worked with them. We have built a GIS interface so that all the industrial zones wherein industries can be set up or companies can be set up, been mapped on a geographical map. And it clearly gives you a clear view on if you want to start, suppose, a business in Tamil Nadu, or if you start a business in the Northeast, or if you want to start a business in, say, Noida, what are the clearances that are required? Where will the land be? What is the process? How long will it take? And how soon you can get going on that? So that's all about ease of doing business. A lot has been done, but a lot more needs to be done. We have constantly improved on the ease of doing business index. In fact, we used to be in the hundreds some time back. Now we have come down to, I think, 47 in the last year's World Bank's rankings on ease of doing business. There are a lot more needs to be done. But we are on that right path. And I would say that anyone who wants to know about doing this can easily come to either on MyGov or to see what the government is doing, or on the Invest India, especially for startups and all, and get to know what all is happening in the policy space.
Yeah, I mean, even on the front that you mentioned, that it's complicated to navigate the website, I think I personally remember even looking at like very early government websites, maybe in early 2000s, trying to like find my way and wade my way through hordes of information that was just unorganized, not relevant oftentimes. So many people struggled with it. But I think there's been this concerted effort towards making the government also function like a startup. It's not just that the government is encouraging startups, but also just that the government itself is starting to think like a startup. How can we make things easier for everyone? How can we help people out? What are the problems that we need to solve, and how can we do them more efficiently?
Yeah, that's very pertinent. In fact, we always feel, what is the one thing that we can change today? Because we also, because when I talk to my team and I say that like our website should not look like a building with 1,000 doors and you don't know which to open. And if you have to open every door to find out where you want to be, you will get frustrated. And and data says that no website gets more than 3 clicks. If you don't get what you're finding in 3 clicks, you leave. So, and I always give the example of, look at Google, what it does. On the website, there is nothing but a box. And it tells you what you want and then it throws back the results to you. So can we not design something on that those lines in which we are able to give the citizen what he wants rather than he trying to find out? Because very often, even when we do in public services, like we have organized government into various departments. There is a rural development department, there is a Panchayati Raj department, there is a local self-government. A citizen wants a service. He doesn't know who will be doing that. We know who is doing that. So why can't we have a single window like a Google window and say the citizen says, I want a driving license. Okay, we say that, okay, based on your geolocation, your mobile phone says that you are located at so-and-so place. This is the office where you go and these, you have to submit 2 photographs, you have to submit this reason, get done with it. So that's where we are going to slowly. And especially AI is helping us in a big manner. Because once we have the data that's at the back end organized and we know who is doing what, citizen need not know. He should see Sarkar and government as one organic whole with whom he can interact and tell what he wants. And then we throw back whatever he needs. And it can happen in an interactive manner. So there have been some efforts, especially we used AI-based chatbots on the COVID communications, wherein we were able to answer people's queries. They can ask anything, like even for the vaccination. Their queries cannot be structured. Somebody may ask that how many doses I need, or will I get only one dose, or will I get 2 doses? So the queries can be structured in any manner they want, but the answers can be mapped by using keywords and by using this. It's a very basic AI 101. So on that, we have been able to work on chatbots, especially for COVID communications and the vaccination communication. But there is no reason it cannot be done for driving licenses, passports, property registration cards, marriage cards, caste certificates, and it's happening. Like I don't know whether you guys have heard about. You might be knowing about the Aadhaar project, and you are knowing about the UPI that we have built in, which are one of the largest digital transformation enablers. Yep. But another project that we are implementing is DigiLocker project. I don't know how many of you are aware.
I want to touch on that later in the podcast, but no, feel free to go ahead and tell us what's it about.
Okay, yeah. You guys might be knowing about DigiLocker because I think you guys are that generation where your 12th and 10th mark sheets would have come on the DigiLocker.
Exactly,
So what it does is that it's a great enabler. Like what we do is that, and what we have got approvals now is that all public documents, when it's concerning a citizen, whether it's their Aadhaar or driving license or their PAN card or their academic documents will be on DigiLocker. We began with the class 10th and 12th, and now we have got the approvals that all academic certificates, including those from higher education, from universities, from IITs, from medical colleges, from law universities, all of them would be issued through the DigiLocker. And it what it does is that it is not only a repository of documents, but it also allows verification services. So, for example, if the Rice University or the Berkeley wants to verify for a grad for a grad school applicant whether he actually studied from an IIT and got a 7.9 GPA, they can actually be as a requester, make a query, and the person who is applying for it will give his consent, and then this information will be pulled out digitally, electronically, without the submission of a paper transcript. So that's the change we are looking at. And this year we tried that, and it worked very beautifully for the Delhi University admissions. Because during the pandemic, Delhi University was struggling with it. How will the students come to various colleges and submit their mark sheets for verification? Because the norms of the lockdown and all did not allow people to come to colleges. So we said that why don't you try a digital API-based verification service? And we offered to them, and 100,000 students got admissions with an API level verification of their class 12th mark sheets, which worked very beautifully, seamlessly. Without taking any time. Then the recruitment processes. Karnataka police was doing constable recruitment. We enabled digital verification of their academic credentials through this interface, API level interface, and it worked. And now caste certificates are being brought into it, passports are being brought into it, and we have built up something called API Setu, which is an API bridge, What it does is that once I have a data in a standard format, and every university, every college adopts those standards, then this API level verification works very beautifully. It's being extended to health records now, yes. Like electronic health records under the National Digital Health Mission. Like I may have my health records, so maybe I have a blood test from All India Institute of Medical Sciences. Maybe I have a CT scan from Max Hospital, and I have an X-ray from Apollo. But suppose I want a second opinion from Medanta. What do I do? Can I give a consent-based access to the doctor at Medanta to look all of my digital documents? It is happening. It's already part of the National Digital Health Mission, and it will be a great enabler in the days to come. Agriculture, similarly, agriculture records, the soil health card records, land records are all being built onto the DigiLocker and integrating that and offering value-added services on top of it. Yesterday, in fact, we had a brainstorming session on something which is much more revolutionary, like dematerialization of land records. Because in India, if you look at the property transactions are one of the biggest sources of corruption. If you know how it works, like very often somebody is buying a property, they will say that the circle rate is the rate at which the government charges the taxes, is lower than the market rate, and you will have to pay a certain portion of that in cash, and only a part of it is in the digital transaction, and it leads to a lot of issues on that. So what we are looking at is that if I have my land records data digitized, if I have cadastral map digitized, and they all are available on a GIS interface, can we think of building a land parcel commodity exchange wherein transactions in property will happen digitally, just like you transact in share markets. And when the seller price and the buyer price matches, a transaction happens, digital payments take place, and whatever is the government's tax gets deducted. So that will be truly transformational. It's easier said than done because there are myriad issues involved. Yeah. But yes, there is a team which is working on that. And I'm sure in the next 5 to 10 years, this will also be a reality.
Wow, that's there's so much to unpack there. There's so many initiatives. Just that's incredible to see. I want to point out that, you know, you mentioned this document verification and sort of a tokenization of document where every document corresponds to a unique token. You can verify its authenticity. This is what's happening in cryptography, or this is what's happening in Bitcoin and cryptocurrency. And I think DocuSign is a business in America, for example, that does exactly what the government of India is doing, except that it is a $1 billion business in the US, perhaps a multi-billion dollar.
Yeah, I think it's worth $40 billion.
It's worth $40 billion, but yeah, in India we're doing the same things. And it's just the scale at which we're doing this is also just immense, and it's just incredible to think about. At this point, I know you mentioned UPI, and I know you mentioned DigiLocker. I want to use that to sort of guide this discussion into more of where do you see which initiatives that the government has taken today, which of those do you think will have the most transformative impact in the next 5 to 10 years? And could you speak to us about what that space will look like, and which space in the entrepreneurship system are you most optimistic about in the immediate and medium term future?
See, the basic principle of whether it's the Aadhaar project, the Unique Identity project, or the UPI project, or the DigiLocker, is to offer services through APIs. So what the Aadhaar does is that if you want to use the identity services of Aadhaar, you can do an API level verification service of a person's identity by using the Aadhaar verification services. If a person is claiming to be XYZ, whether he is XYZ or not, can be verified through the Aadhaar. So the identity piece, which is a basic KYC kind of challenge in anything that you do, whether in agriculture, whether in healthcare, whether in skills training, or whether in any domain, that's a basic thing. So that is enabled by Aadhaar. Payments, so if you're building up a solution, if you're building up any kind of solution, if you want to integrate a UPI into that solution, if you want to enable the digital payments, today it's available as a building block that you can just put it onto your solution and use it. DigiLocker, with its consent framework, what it does is that it allows storage of documents, it allows access of documents, it allows consent-based verification of documents. So using these three pieces with the consent architecture, you can build any solution on top of it. And the basic principle behind all these things is providing open API access to these services. So they are become like Lego pieces which fit in. And on top of it, you can build in your value-added services. Like, for example, agriculture. If somebody wants to build up a agriculture product service, he can use these pieces. And then if the land records data, the GIS data is also available in an open API-based system, then if you are looking at, offering a service in agri-advisory to farmers, if you can get access to the digital land records data, if you can get access to the soil health card data, if you can get access to the weather data, which are all available in the open data formats and through open APIs, then you could merge the soil health, what kind of soil is there, what kind of rainfall is expected in a particular year, what kind of crop history has been there, who is the owner of that plot of land, and you can offer agri advice. And since Aadhaar is linked to mobile phones also, you could offer agri advisory services to farmers on his mobile phone in his local language, telling him what to sow, when to sow, when is the rains expected, where to get the fertilizers from, where to get the seeds from. So all of these things can be integrated and built on top of this basic structure that has been created. So that's a key area in which a lot of applications will be there. If you look at healthcare, again, health ID linked to the Aadhaar ID, followed by using digital payment system, you could build up a telemedicine solution on top of it. So that a doctor registry is there under the National Digital Health Mission, a health registry, a health facility registry is there, and there are people who are accessing the health services with their identities. So all these things can be integrated. And since the DigiLocker is also the health locker, all the advisories, all the consultancy which a health doctor is offering, they can be stored in the DigiLocker of a individual. So health services on top of these basic building blocks can be built in. And once the telemedicine services are there, linking it up to e-pharmacies and all will become very easy. So the architecture that we have envisaged with an open API framework is to provide a platformization of services. There will be certain basic services like the identity piece, the payment piece, and the DigiLocker piece. And on top of it, there will be value-added services of various departments. And if the output of these is also available with an open API access, anybody can build more better services on top of it. Like the income tax department, they built the basic income tax solution. But on top of it, you have companies like ClearTax and other companies who have built in solutions on top of it. Right. So that's where the real value lies in, building on top of it. We also have come up with a framework for non-personal data sharing policy. Like wherever data is anonymized and available on an aggregate level, how will the sharing happen? So that which will lead to creation of data businesses and protocols and commercials of data exchange. So if you build on top of that, using the hopefully the non-personal data framework will be notified soon, then that will provide you access to data that you don't have. That data might be lying with, say, with a telecom operator or like, for example, mobility data. Mobility data might be lying with a telecom operator or with Google. But can you get access to that data? There has been a policy notified to get that data. Using the data, using the building blocks, a lot of services can be built in. Education is similarly another area in which we see a lot of potential. The Diksha platform has transformed the availability of content. But the biggest challenge anyone in India faces is how to find which are the schools to get admitted to, which are the schools, how the schools are rated.
Right.
So people can, using the GIS piece that is available, using the UDIS data, which has mapped all the schools with a unique ID, one can build a service like that with the rating of schools, finding schools. So these are the sectors in which I hope a lot of growth and a lot of opportunities in the next few years, whether it's education, healthcare, agriculture, and value-added services on top of it.
Okay. I'm blown away by the magnitude and B, even the quantity of the initiatives that the government has taken. I, like I said before, I wasn't aware of either the GEM initiative or the policy changes on the large scale, but also these initiatives in terms of, you know, the, for example, the Diksha platform or Health ID. Again, these are some things that I wasn't aware of, but after listening to you talk about them, I feel like the future is looking bright. Let me just say that. It's not just the government taking these initiatives and building them on a large scale. It's also the fact that people can build businesses on top of these services. which I think will be a key part in the future. And I think what is required for the progress of a nation, it's not just the businessmen creating businesses, it's not just the government driving up policies on their own without feedback from the citizens. It's the synergy of these multiple parties, and that's, I think, what drives progress in the long run. Shifting gears for a bit, you mentioned that you're the CEO of MyGov. You're also the CEO of Digital India Corporation. So just tell us about your role on sort of a day-to-day basis or like a monthly basis. What is your role like, and how do you even come up with what to work on next in terms of both you and your organization?
See, MyGov is as you guys might be knowing, I don't know whether you subscribe to MyGov on social media or to the MyGov app. MyGov is the citizen engagement platform of Government of India. What it does is that it connects to the citizens for a two-way communication. Like very often in a democracy, we always say for the people, by the people, of the people. But very often people do not get a chance to take part in policy formulation. Maybe they only get a chance to elect the government, which happens once in 5 years. And after that, they don't know where to go. And the normal refrain is that koi nahi sunta. So to bridge this gap, the MyGov started this, MyGov.in portal was launched along with an app and along with business social media channels. And what it does is that it does consultations on policy issues. Like whenever the Government of India is coming up with any major policy, the citizens' views are taken with regard to what the citizens or various stakeholders want from the government with regard to those policies. So like, for example, when the budget was being formulated, so the finance ministry invited suggestions from citizens with regard to the budget inputs, whatever they wanted. We got almost 40,000 inputs. These were shared with the finance ministry. Around 94 of them, I'm told, did find a mention in the budget. And then that consultation was happened. After the budget has been passed, now the implementation has come to core. The government organized 8 webinars with various stakeholders with regard to how the budget proposals will be implemented, because this year's budget has got several new path-breaking initiatives. So in order to continue the consultation, we have launched a consultation, a campaign page on getting citizens' views on budget implementation. Every month, Honorable Prime Minister addresses a radio podcast called Mann Ki Baat on the last Sunday of every month, in which he kind of talks about several initiatives. He talks about his views on what is impacting the people the most, and generally it's a very well followed radio show in India. So, but in order to get inputs with regard to what the citizens want the PM to talk about, every month we launch we have an ideas page on MyGov in which we invite citizens to give their suggestions with regard to what they would want the Prime Minister to address on. And it's not only a forum in which people can give their views. It's there. We also have a toll-free number on which people can call and record what they want to say to the Honorable Prime Minister. And we get these calls, we analyze them, we transcribe them, we do text analytics, and we do various kinds of analytics, pick up the common threads, common themes, and then share it with the Prime Minister's office. And some of it is actually chosen and discussed there. So on one side, it provides, MyGov provides a channel for people to communicate with the highest authority in the country. And the second important thing that MyGov does is disseminating information. How do we break down what the government is saying into easy, simple to understand terms and communicate it on various forums, on our website, on our app, and more importantly, on social media. Because very often, very few citizens will know the URLs of government websites, and nobody will come visiting our websites or download our apps. So what we do is that we go to where citizens are. Where are they? They're on Instagram, they're on Facebook, they're on Twitter, they're on LinkedIn, they're on Pinterest, they're on the Indian apps like ShareChat, Koo, Chingari, which is a short video app, the TikTok equivalent. And we go and communicate there in very short, like very often our communications will be like 30 second long, because the attention span of people is very limited. So if we want to tell people about certain things, like for example, last year when we started the COVID campaign, when we were brainstorming on how to do it, my team member said, quarantine. I asked my team, how many of you know what quarantine means? In February 2020, 90% of people did not know what quarantine meant in India. That was not part of the lexicon.
Yeah.
Today, everybody knows. So we had to break it down. We have to use videos. We have to use infographics. We have to use doctors' testimonials and communicate that. Then the lockdown instruction schemes, MHAs, what is allowed, what is not allowed, who can fly, who cannot fly, how to do that. It became very complicated, which is, of course, because they are issuing those orders under a particular act, so they have to follow a legalese, bureaucratic language. Right. But we broke it down into infographics, easy to understand graphics, videos, communicating, so that people understand. So dissemination, information dissemination is a big thing that we do. So then there are innovation challenges that we do. There are pledges that we do. There are quizzes that we do, which find a lot of engagement. Right now, we are doing something called Pariksha Pe Charcha, which is again an event which the Honorable Prime Minister addresses every year for to kids for how to manage stress for exams. So that this year, in fact, we made it open internationally. And apart from India, we have got entries from almost 96 countries worldwide. The event will happen on 23rd when Honorable Prime Minister will address. But all these 2,000 kids who will attend that event will be chosen through MyGov platform. It's a daily activity. Something or the other keeps on going on. So we have a vibrant team of people, mostly from the private sector, on contract, young people who are very creative, who think of different creative ways to communicate. We have a separate team for Instagram, separate for LinkedIn, separate for Twitter, because all these platforms work differently. It's not that whatever works on Twitter will work on Instagram also. And there are new trends coming in. And so for example, even this recent Instagram meme which started, Pauri ho rahi hai. So usme also my team did something. Ki ye main hu, ye mera mask hai, aur ye social distancing hai, aur hum aise paari kar rahe hain. Basically trying to say that ki social distancing, even if you are partying, you have to follow social distancing. So what it does is that it simplifies communications, government communications. So that's my regular day at MyGov. But of course, I have other responsibilities as the Digital India Corporation, wherein I look after DigiLocker. Then Umang is another project that we are doing. Umang is a super app. I don't know whether you guys know or not. All government apps on one platform. We have almost 20,000 services out there. Wow. Because whenever we look at government portals and government apps, like going digital is all right. But in the physical world, people used to go from pillar to post. In the digital world, you may go from portal to portal or app to app. And very often, you won't even know which is a legit app and which is a fake app. To solve this problem and to bring all the apps together, we launched this Umang mobile platform, which will give you access to all your services, whatever you need, depending on your profile, depending on your geolocation. If you're a farmer, you'll get access to farmer-based services. If you're a student, you'll get access to textbooks, scholarships, other services. So multiple projects, multiple initiatives, a lot of interaction with young people, brainstorming, and a lot of time also wasted in boring meetings. That's part of our routine.
Oh yeah, that's part of everyone's job.
That never changes, whatever you do.
That's awesome. Cool. I just want to, I think this has been very informative. I've learned so much, and I'm sure our viewers would have learned so much as well. I want to tie it back into our original question, or why we do this podcast, which is we see India as this place that can become the next Silicon Valley. Do you think it can become the next Silicon Valley, Abhishek?
See, we already have a lot of companies and a lot of startups. We have the potential, but we do need a lot of more investments in research and computational facilities before we can claim to be Silicon Valley. I think what we need to do is that we should try to think of becoming the Indian Valley and try to do the way we do things here, and build in the partnerships that kind of exist worldwide. So we are much behind US and China, if you look at about the level of cooperation, coordination between academia, industry, and the government. So our research institutions need a lot more investment in research labs and trying to create facilities wherein they can allow students to work on projects in partnership with industry. So we have a potential, but yes, in 5 to 10 years we could be there, but not easy. It's not that we are there yes tomorrow. There's a lot of catch up to be done, especially when you look at investments in frontier technologies, investments in blockchain, investments in artificial intelligence, the kind of quantum computing infrastructure that is required. the kind of supercomputing infrastructure that was required, because if you look at the top 500 fastest supercomputers worldwide, India has only 3 of them there. China and all are much ahead. If you look at the research citations, if you look at research papers, we have much ground to cover. It's we do have the potential, we do have the dream, but we cannot be complacent in saying that, yes, we have everything going to be the next Silicon Valley. There's a lot more hard work to be done, a lot more investments to be done by the government, by the private sector, and a lot more work expected from labs and universities before we can claim our place.
Awesome. I think Indian Valley is an earworm that will stick with all of us. Thank you so much, Abhishek. We appreciate you coming here today and talking with us.
Thank you, Abhishek.
Thank you.